matter with you all? Have you eaten something, or is it a wicked falsehood? I will not have this skulking. Do not trifle with your duty, sir, or you will find yourself at the masthead pretty soon, I can tell you.
Six bells struck,
and Jack turned to keep his appointment to drink tea with Mr. Stanhope. He liked the envoy more the better he knew him, though Mr. Stanhope was one of the most ineffectual men he'd met. There was something touching about his anxiety to give no trouble, his gratitude for all they did for him in the way of accommodation, his hopelessly misdirected consideration for the hands, and his fortitude. Never a word of complaint after the squall and all its wreckage. Once he had established that Jack and Harvey were connected with families he knew, he treated them as human beings, all the others as dogs, but as good, quite intelligent dogs in a dog-loving community. He was ceremonious, naturally kind, and he had a great and oppressive sense of duty. He greeted Jack with renewed apologies for doing so in the captain's own cabin.
"You must be sadly cramped, I'm afraid," he said, "quite miserably confined, a great trial."
And poured him a cup of tea in a way that reminded Jack irresistibly of his great-aunt Letty's. The same priestly gestures, the same droop of the wrist, the same grave concentration. They talked about His Excellency's flute, a quarter tone too high in this extraordinary heat, about Rio and the refreshments to be expected there, about the naval custom of having 13 months in the year, and Mr. Stanhope said, "I've often meant to ask you, sir, why my naval friends and acquaintance so often refer to the Surprise as the Nemesis. Was her name changed? Was she taken from the French?"
"Why, sir, it's more a kind of nickname that we have in the service, much as we call Britannia Old Ironsides.
You may remember the Hermione, sir, in 97.
A ship of that name? No, I believe not.
She was a 32-gun frigate on the West Indies station. And I'm sorry to say her people mutinied, killed their officers, and carried her into La Guayra on the Spanish main."
"Oh, deeply shocking. I'm distressed to hear it."
"It was an ugly business. And the Spaniards wouldn't give her up either. So, to put it in a word, Edward Hamilton, who had the Surprise then, went and cut her out. She was moored head and stern in Puerto Cabello, one of the closest harbours in the world, under their batteries, which had some 200 guns in them. And the Spaniards were rowing guard, too, since the Surprise had stood in with the land, and they were aware of her motions. Still, that night, he went in with the boats, boarded her, and brought her away. He killed 119 of her crew, wounded 97 with very little loss, though he was shockingly knocked about himself. Oh, it was a most brilliant piece of service. I would have given my right hand to be there. So the Admiralty changed Hermione's name to Retribution, and in the service people call the Surprise the Nemesis, seeing that..." Through the open skylight he heard the masthead hail the deck. The launch had put off from the shore, followed by two canoes. Mr. Stanhope went on for some time, gently prosing away about Nemesis, Retribution, just deserts, the inevitability of eventual punishment for all transgressions, the crime bore within it the fatal seeds of the criminal's undoing, and lamenting the depravity of the mutineers. But no doubt they were led on, incited by some wretched Jacobin or radical, and plied with spirits to attack properly constituted authority in such a barbarous fashion. I trust they were severely dealt with.
We have a short way with mutineers, sir. We hanged all we could lay our hands on. Ran them up the yardarm directly with the Rogue's March playing. An ugly business, however," he added.
He had known the infamous Captain Pigott, the cause of the mutiny. and he had known several of the decent men who had been goaded into it. An odious memory. Now, sir, if you will forgive me, I believe I must go on deck to see what Dr. Maturin has brought us.
Dr. Maturin's returning? I rejoice to hear it. I'll come with you, if I may. I have a great esteem for Dr. Maturin, a most valuable, ingenious gentleman. I have no objection to a little originality. My friends often quiz me for it myself. May I beg you to give me your arm?
Valuable and ingenious he might be, thought Jack, fixing him with his glass, but false he was too, and perjured. He had voluntarily sworn to have no truck with vampires, and there, attached to his bosom, spread over it and enfolded by one arm, was a greenish, hairy thing like a mat. A loathsome great vampire of the most poisonous kind, no doubt.
I should never have believed it of him. His sacred oath in the morning watch, and now he stuffs the ship with vampires. And God knows what's in that bag. No doubt he was tempted, but surely he must blush for his fall.
No blush. Nothing but a look of idiot delight as he came slowly up the side, hampered by his burden, and comforting it in Portuguese as he came.
I'm happy to see that you were so successful, Dr. Maturin, he said, looking down into the launch and the canoes, loaded with glowing heaps of oranges and shaddocks, red meat, iguanas, bananas, green stuff. But I'm afraid no vampires can be allowed on board.
This is a sloth, said Stevens, smiling at him. A three-toed sloth. The most affectionate, discriminating sloth you can imagine.
The sloth turned its round head, fixed its eyes on Jack, uttered a despairing wail, and buried its face again in Stephen's shoulder, tightening its grip to the strangling point.
Come, Jack, disengage his right arm, if you please. You needn't be afraid. Excellency, pray be so good. The left arm, gently disengaging the claws. There. There, my fine fellow. Now, let us carry him below. Handsomely, handsomely. Do not alarm the sloth, I beg.
The sloth was not easily alarmed. As soon as it was provided with a piece of hawser stretched taut in the cabin, it went fast asleep, hanging by its claws and swaying with the roll, as it might have done in the wind-rocked branches of its native forest. Indeed, apart from its candid distress at the sight of Jack's face, it was perfectly adapted for a life at sea. It was uncomplaining. It required no fresh air, no light. It throve in a damp, confined atmosphere. It could sleep in any circumstances. It was tenacious of life. It put up with any hardship. It accepted biscuit, gratefully, and pap. And in the evenings it would hobble on deck, walking on its claws, and creep into the rigging, hanging there upside down and advancing 2 or 3 yards at a time with pauses for sleep. Hans loved it from the first, and would often carry it into the tops or higher. They declared it brought the ship good luck. That was difficult to see why, since the wind rarely blew east of south, and that but feebly, day after day. Yet the fresh provisions had their astonishingly rapid effect. In a week's time the sick bay was almost empty, and the Surprise, fully manned and cheerful, had recovered her old form, her high-masted trim appearance. She returned to her exercising of the great guns, laid aside for the more urgent repairs, and every day the trade wind carried away great wafts of her powder smoke. At first this perturbed the sloth. It scuttled, almost ran below, its claws going clack, clack, clack in the silence between one broadside and the next. But by the time they'd passed directly under the sun and the wind came strong and true at last, it slept through the whole exercise. hanging in its usual place, in the mizzen catharpins, above the quarter-deck carronades, just as it slept through the marine's musketry and Stephen's pistol practice. All through this tedious, tedious passage, even in the northeast trades, the frigate had not shown of her best. But now, with the steady, urgent rush of air, this strong ocean of wind, she behaved like the old surprise of Jack Aubrey's youth. He wasn't satisfied with her trim, nor with the present rake of her masts, nor with the masts themselves, far less with the state of her bottom. Yet still, with the wind just far enough abaft the beam for the stunsel to set pretty, she ran with the old magical life and thrust. A particular living, supple command of the sea that he would have recognized at once if he'd been set down upon a deck blindfolded. The sun had gone down in a brief crimson blaze. The night was sweeping up from the east over a moonless sky, a deeper blue with every minute, and every wave-top began to glow with inner fire. The acting third lieutenant paused in his strut on the windward side of the sloping quarter-deck and called over to leeward, "Mr. Braithwaite, are you ready with the log there?" Babington didn't dare come it very high with his former messmates yet, but he cut many a charming caper over the midshipman of the starboard berth, balm to his soul, and this unnecessary question was intended only to compel Braithwaite to reply, "All ready and along, sir." The bell struck. Braithwaite heaved the log clear of the stronger phosphorescence racing down the frigate's side. The line tore off the reel. At the quartermaster's cry, he checked the run, jerked the pin, hauled the log aboard and shouted, "We've done it! We've done it! 11 on the nose!" "It's not true," cried Babington, his dignity all sunk in delight. "Let's have another go." They heaved the log again, watched it dwindle in the shining turmoil of the wake, more brilliant now with the darkening of the sky, and with his fingers on the running line, Babington nipped on the 11th knot itself, shrieking, "11! "What are you at?" asked Jack, behind the excited huddle of midshipmen. "I'm just checking Mr. Braithwaite's accuracy, sir," said the third lieutenant. "Oh, sir, we're doing 11 knots. 11 knots, sir, ain't it prime?" Jack smiled, felt the iron-taut backstay, and walked forward to where Stephen and Mr. White, the envoy's chaplain, were crouching on the forecastle, braced against the lean of the ship, and clinging haphazard to anything, kevels, beckets, even the burning metal of the horse. "Is it settled yet?" he asked. "We are waiting for the agreed moment, sir," said the chaplain. "Perhaps you'd be so good as to keep time and see all's fair. A whole bottle of pale ale depends upon this. The moment Venus sets, Dr. Maturin is to read from the first page he opens by the phosphorescence alone." "Not footnotes," said Stephen. Jack glanced up, and there against the Southern Cross, high on the humming to gallant forestay, was the Sloth, rocking easy with the rhythm of the ship. "I doubt you have too much starlight," he said. At this speed, the frigate's bow wave rose high, washing the lee headrails with an unearthly blue-green light, and sending phosphorescent drops over them, even more brilliant than the wake that tore out straight behind them, a ruled line 3 miles long, gleaming like a flow of metal. For a moment, Jack fixed the glowing spray as it was whirled inboard and then across the face of the foresail by the currents from the jibs and staysail. And then he turned his eyes westwards, where the planet was as low on the horizon as she could be. The round glow touched the sea, reappeared on the rise, vanished entirely. and the starlight distinctly lost in power. "She dips," he cried. Stephen opened the book, and holding it with the page to the bow wave, he read, "Speed the soft intercourse from soul to soul, and waft a sigh from Indus to the pole." "Mr. White, I exult, I triumph, I claim my bottle, and Lord, Lord, how I shall enjoy it. Such a thirst! Captain Aubrey, I beg you will share our battle. Come, lethargy!" he called, directing his voice into the velvet sky. "Oh! Oh!" cried the chaplain, staggering into the booms. "A fish! A fish has hit me! A flying fish hit me in the face!" "There's another," said Stephen, picking it up. "You notice that your high fishes fly paradoxically with the wind. I conceive there must be an upward draft. How they gleam! A whole flight! See? See? Here's a third! I shall offer it lightly flying to my sloth!" "I cannot imagine," said Jack, recovering the chaplain and guiding him along the gangway, "what that sloth has against me. I've always been civil to it, more than civil, but nothing answers. I cannot think why you speak of its discrimination." Jack was of a sanguine temperament. He liked most people, and he was surprised when they didn't like him. This readiness to be pleased had been damaged of recent years, but it remained intact as far as horses, dogs, and sloths were concerned. It wounded him to see tears come into the creature's eyes when he walked into the cabin, and he laid himself out to be agreeable. As they ran down to Rio, he sat with it at odd moments, addressing it in Portuguese, more or less, and feeding it with offerings that it sometimes ate, sometimes allowed to drool slowly from its mouth. But it was not until they were approaching Capricorn, with Rio no great distance on the starboard bow, that he found it respond. The weather had freshened almost to coldness, for the wind was coming more easterly from the chilly currents between Tristan and the Cape. The sloth was amazed by the change. It shunned the deck and spent its time below. Jack was in his cabin, pricking the chart with less satisfaction than he could have wished. Progress, slow, serious trouble with the mainmast, unaccountable headwinds by night, and sipping a glass of grog. Stephen was in the mizzen-top, teaching Bondon to write and scanning the sea for his first albatross. The sloth sneezed, and looking up, Jack caught its gaze fixed upon him. Its inverted face had an expression of anxiety and concern. "Try a piece of this, old cock," he said, dipping his cake in the grog and proffering the sop. "It might put a little heart into you." The sloth sighed, closed its eyes, but gently absorbed the piece, and sighed again. Some minutes later he felt a touch on his knee. The sloth had silently climbed down, and it was standing there, its beady eyes looking up into his face, bright with expectation. More cake, more grog, growing confidence and esteem. After this, as soon as the drum had beat the retreat, the sloth would meet him, hurrying towards the door on its uneven legs. It was given its own bowl, and it would grip it with its claws, lowering its round face into it and pursing its lips to drink. Its tongue was too short to lap. Sometimes it went to sleep in this position, bowed over the emptiness. "In this bucket," said Stephen, walking into the cabin, "in this small half-bucket now, I have the population of Dublin, London, and Paris combined. These animalculae... What's the matter with the sloth? It was curled on Jack's knee, breathing heavily. Its bowl and Jack's glass stood empty on the table. Stephen picked it up, peered into its affable, bleary face, shook it, and hung it upon its rope. It seized hold with one fore and one hind foot, letting the others dangle, limp, and went to sleep. Stephen looked sharply round, saw the decanter, smote to the sloth, and cried, "Jack! You have debauched my sloth!" On the other side of the cabin bulkheads, Mr. Atkins said to Mr. Stallop, "High words between the captain and the doctor, sir. Ho-ho! Pretty strong. He pitches it pretty strong. I wonder a man of spirit can stomach it. I should give him a thrashing directly." Mr. Stanhope had no notion of listening behind bulkheads, and he didn't reply. But he couldn't prevent himself from catching isolated sentiments such as, "T'es mère crapuleuse! Tu cherches à corrompre mon paresseux! Va donc, salope! Espèce de fripouille!" For the dialogue had switched to French on the entrance of the wooden-faced Killick. "I hope they'll not be late for our whist," he murmured. Now that the air had grown breathable, Mr. Stanhope's strength had revived, and he looked forward keenly to these evenings of cards, the only break in the unspeakable tedium of ocean travel. They were not late. They appeared at the stroke of the hour, but their faces were red, and Stephen was seen to cheat in order to have the envoy as his partner. Jack played abominably. Stephen, with a malignant concentration, darting out his trumps like a serpent's tooth. He excelled himself in post-mortems, showing clearly how his opponents might have drawn the singleton king, saved the rubber, trumped the ace, and the evening broke up with no slackening of the tension. They looked at him nervously as they settled the monstrous score, and with a factitious air of cheerfulness, Jack said, "Well, gentlemen, if the master's reckoning is as deadly accurate as Dr. Maturin's leads, and if the wind holds, I believe you'll wake up tomorrow in Rio de Janeiro. I feel the loom of the land. I feel it in my bones." In the dead hour of the middle watch, he appeared on deck in his nightshirt, looked attentively at the logboard by the binnacle light, and desired Pullings to shorten sail at 8 bells. He appeared again, like a restless ghost, at 5 bells, and backed his topsails for a while. His calculations were remarkably exact, and he brought the frigate into Rio just as the sun rose behind her and bathed the whole fantastic spectacle in golden light. Yet even this did not answer. Even this didn't close the breach. Stephen, on being routed out of bed to behold it, observed that it was curious how vulgar nature could be at times. Meretricious ad captandum vulgus effects, very much the kind of thing attempted to be accomplished at Astley's or Ranelagh, and fortunately missed of. He might have thought of other observations, for the sloth had been slowly sick all night in his cabin. But at this moment, the surprise erupted in flames and smoke, saluting the Portuguese admiral as he lay there in a crimson 74 under Rat Island. Jack went ashore with Mr. Stanhope after breakfast, his bargemen shaved and trim in sennit hats and snowy duck, and himself in his best uniform. And when he came back, there was not the least trace of reserve, propitiation, or hauteur in his expression. Bondon was carrying a bag, and from far off the cry of "Post!" went round the waiting ship. "Captain's compliments, and should be happy if you could spare him a moment," said Church, the ratty vor. Then, grasping Stephen's sleeve, he added in an urgent whisper, "And, sir, please, please, would you put in a good word for Scott and me to go ashore? We have deserved it." Wondering just how Mr. Church thought he'd deserved anything short of impalement, Stephen walked into the cabin. It was filled with a rosy smile, with contentment and the smell of porter. Jack sat there at his table behind a number of open letters from Sophia, two glasses and a jug. "There you are, my dear Stephen," he cried. "Come and drink a glass of porter with the Irish Franciscan's compliments. I have had 5 letters from Sophie, and there are some from you, from Sussex too, I believe." They were lying on a heap of others addressed to Dr. Maturin, and the hand was undoubtedly Sophie's. "What a splendid hand she writes, don't you find?" said Jack. "You can make out every word, and really such a style, such a style! I wonder how she could have got such a style. They must be some of the best letters that were ever wrote. There's a piece here about the garden at Melbury and the pears that I'll read to you presently, as good as anything in all literature. But don't mind me, I beg, if you choose to look at yours now. Don't stand on ceremony."
"I will not," said Stephen, absently putting them into his pocket, and shuffling through the rest, Sir Joseph, Ramis, Waring, 4 unknowns. "Tell me, were there any letters for Mr. Nichols?"
"Nichols? No, none. Plenty for the rest of the gunroom, however. Killick!"
"What now, sir?" said Killick angrily, with a spoon in his hand. "Gunroom, steward, post, and bring another jug. Stephen, just look at this, will you?"
He handed a letter. Mr. Fanshawe presented his compliments to Captain Aubrey, and had the honour to state that he had this day received the sum of £9,755.13.4 from the Admiralty, representing an ex gratia payment to Captain A in respect of the detention of His Most Catholic Majesty's ships Clara, Farmer, Medea, and Mercedes. That their lordships did not have it in contemplation to make any payment of head money or gun money, nor for the hulls. And that the above-mentioned sum, less sundry advances, as per margin and the usual commission, had been paid into Captain A's account with Messrs. Hawes Banking House.
"It is not what you'd call handsome," said Jack, laughing,
"but a bird in the hand is worth any amount of beating about the bush, don't you agree? And it pretty well clears me of debt. Now all I need is a couple of moderate prizes, and then, upon my word, I can't see what Mother Williams can possibly object to. To be sure, there's not a smell of a merchantman left this side of Batavia. Not lawful prize, I mean. And God preserve me from sending in another neutral. But still, they have some privateers cruising from the Isle of France, and a brush with one or two of them." The old, eager, piratical gleam was in his eye. He looked 5 years younger. "But, Stephen, I've been thinking about you. I must heave the ship down, restow her. Mr. Stanhope's dunnage and presence are all a who in the afterhold. Get her more by the head, shift all manner of things. And it occurred to me, now you are so amazingly agile, should not you like to take a week's leave and ride into the interior? Jaguars, ostriches, unicorns. Oh, Jack, how truly good of you. I had to put violence upon myself to come away from Cape St. Roque, to abandon that vegetable magnificence. The Brazilian forest is the haunt of the tapir, the boar, the peccary. You may find it hard to credit, Jack, but never yet have I beheld a boar." Boas he had beheld, and handled, too. Hummingbirds, fireflies. The toucan in his glory peering from his nest, the anteater and her child tinted purple by the sunrise over a desolate swamp, armadillos, three kinds of New World monkey, a true tapir he'd seen before he came back to the ship at Rio, having worn three horses and Mr. White, his companion, to a shadow. Here, riding at single anchor, he found a strangely altered surprise, with a 36-gun frigate's mainmast, her fore and mizzen raked strongly aft, and her sides repainted black and white, the Nelson Checker. "It's a plan of my own," said Jack, welcoming him aboard, "something between the lively and the old surprise I knew as a boy. It'll move her in light airs with her narrow entrance, do you see? And, above all, give her an extra knot under a press of canvas. You're going to object to her top hamper, I know." Stephen was gaping up at an immature parrot. "But I tossed out all my shingle ballast and replaced it with pig iron. I cannot tell you how kind the Admiral's been. And we've stowed it low. She's as stiff as... why, as stiff as you can imagine. And if we cannot get an extra knot, I shall be amazed. We may need it, for Lyra was in. And she tells us Linois has passed into the Indian Ocean with a ship of the line, two frigates and a corvette. You remember Linois, Stephen? Monsieur de Linois, who captured us in the Sophie. Yes, yes, I remember him perfectly. A cheerful, polite gentleman in a red waistcoat. And a prodigious good seaman, too. But if I can help it, he shall not catch us again, not in his 74. The frigates are another matter. The Belle Poole's a heavy great brute. 40 guns to our 28, and 24-pounders. But the Semillante is smaller, and we should stand a chance with her, if only I can get our people to move brisk and fire straight. That would be something like a prize, eh? Do you apprehend any immediate danger? Have these vessels been seen at the Cape? No, no, they're 10,000 miles away. They've come into the Indian Ocean by the Sunda Strait. Then is it not perhaps a little premature? Not a bit, not a bit. Even from the service point of view, there's not a moment to be lost. The crew's not half worked up, nothing like the Lively's, not a patch on the Sophie's. And then again, you know, I do so long to be married. The idea of being married drives a man, by God, you can have no idea. Married to Sophie, I mean. I beg pardon if I've spoke awkward again. Why, my dear, I'm no great friend to marriage, as you know. And sometimes I wonder whether you may not set too great a store on a contract compelling you to be happy. Whether any arrival can amount to the sum of voyages. Whether, in fact, it would not be better to travel indefinitely. His own letters from Sophia told a wretched tale of persecution. Mrs. Williams's health was really breaking up. The president of the College of Physicians and Sir John Butler were not men to be deceived by vapours or hypochondria, and there were some ugly, ugly symptoms. But her strong, restless mind seemed to have gathered fresh energy. Sometimes, touchingly pale and racked with pain, she bore real pain with great fortitude. Sometimes her red, angry self, she was battering her daughter with Mr. Hinksey, the new parson. In an exhausted voice from what she called her deathbed, she would beg her daughter to give up this Captain Aubrey, who would never make her happy, who was going to India, everyone knew why, who was going to India after that woman, and to let her mother die in peace, knowing her safely married and settled in swiving rectory so near at hand, among all their connections so comfortable, not in seaside lodgings the other end of England or in Peru, married and settled with a man all her friends approved, the man with handsome private means and brilliant prospects, the man who could make a proper provision for her, and who would look after her sisters when their mother was gone. Poor motherless girls. A man to whom Sophie was not indifferent, whatever she might say. Captain Aubrey would soon get over it, if indeed he was not over it already, in the arms of some trollop.
As his precious Lord Nelson said, every man was a bachelor once he was beyond Gibraltar. And India was a great way beyond Gibraltar if the Atlas was to be believed. In any case, Admiral Haddock and every gentleman of the Navy she'd ever known all said, sea, water, and distance wash love away. They were all of the same opinion. She only spoke for Sophie's good, and she implored her not to refuse this last request, for the sake of her sisters, even if her mother's happiness meant nothing to her. Stephen knew Hinksey, the new rector. A tall, well-looking, gentlemanlike man, a sound scholar, nothing of the evangelical, amusing, witty, kind. Stephen loved and esteemed Sophie more than any woman he knew, but he expected heroic virtue in no one. Not heroic virtue of long duration, with few allies and they 10,000 miles away. 10,000 miles, and how many weeks, months, even years? Time meant one thing in an active, ever-changing life, quite another in a remote provincial house, cooped up with a strong woman devoid of scruple, convinced of her divine rectitude. In any case, Mrs. Williams' fear and detestation of debt was wholly genuine, and this gave her argument a strength and truth far beyond her ordinary reach. In her quiet, settled part of the country, imprisonment for debt did not happen. And the shocking tales she'd heard from outlying regions or from the dissolute giddy metropolis concerned only raffish adventurers or worse. Though her whole childhood had been tinged by whispered, apocalyptic accounts of people so abandoned by God as to have lost their capital in the South Sea bubble. By her own efforts, Mrs. Williams, like all the people she knew, might have earned fivepence a day at weeding or plain sewing, though some of the gentlemen might have done a little better at haysail and harvest. The accumulation of £100 was utterly beyond their powers, that of 10,000 beyond their imagination, and they worshipped capital with an unshakable, uncomprehending, steady devotion, not devoid of superstitious practices. Stephen had reflected upon this at the time of reading Sophie's letters. He had reflected upon it as he walked in the Brazilian forest, gazing at vast cataracts of orchids and butterflies the size of soup plates. He reflected upon it now. The infinitesimal time of thought. The interval was barely long enough for Jack's expression to change from embarrassment to a hint of puzzled anxiety, sensing the motive behind Stephen's words, before a message with the news of the launch putting off with Mr. Stanhope aboard turned it to pleasure and relief. "I was so afraid we should miss the tide," he said, running up the ladder into the swarming anthill on deck. Swarming, but orderly. Whatever he might say about their being only half worked up, the surprises moved about their preparations to get under way with diligent purpose. The raccoon was now forgotten. The landmen had left the plough and the loom far, far behind. And in their battles ashore with the crew of the Lyra, the frigate's libertymen had fought as a body. There was not a man whose straw hat did not fly a ribbon with surprise embroidered on it. The ceremony of reception, Mr. Stanhope never came aboard incognito, the clash of the marines presenting arms, the long-expected order up anchor, the bosun's pipe, and the crunch of the soldiers' boots as they ran to their places at the capstan bars. The spell on land, prolonged to the last possible minute, had restored Mr. Stanhope's spirits. But, thought Stephen, looking into his face, it hadn't done a great deal for his health. It had also taken away his sea legs.
He and Stealing were discussing the official letters that had reached him from England and from India, when the tide turned against the wind, and the Surprise, heading out to sea, began to caper like a rocking horse.
"You will forgive me, Dr. Maturin," he said. "I think I'll lie down. I have little hope of its doing any good. I know that in an hour's time this cold salivation will reach its paroxysm, and that I shall become an inhuman being, unfit for decent company for how long? Oh, Lord, how long?"
Stephen stayed with him as long as human comfort was supportable, then left him to his valet and a bucket, observing, "You will be better soon, very soon. You will grow accustomed to the motion far sooner than you did in the Channel, off Gibraltar, off Madeira. Your sufferings will soon be at an end." Little did he believe it, however. He had read books of voyages. He had conversed with Pullings, who, sailing with the China-bound East Indiaman, had made this trip several times, and he knew the reputation of the high southern latitudes. For this was not an ordinary passage to India. The Cape of Good Hope had been handed back to the Dutch, with bows and smiles, in the year 2. Clearly it would have to be taken from them again, but in the meantime the Surprise must run down far to the south of Africa, to the Roaring Forties, make her easting, and so northwards to the waters where the summer monsoon blew. The frigate ran down the trades as though she were determined to make up for lost time. The difference in her sailing was apparent to everyone aboard. Easier, faster, more stylish by far. Jack was charmed. He explained to Stephen that she was very like a thoroughbred mare, needed a light, careful hand, had to be steered small, had beautiful manners on a wind and stayed like a cutter. But a captious fellow might fault her going large, a very slight tendency to steer wild, that called for great attention at the helm to prevent her being pooped. "I should be sorry indeed to see her pooped," he said, shaking his head. "Was she to broach to, I shouldn't like to answer for that damn foremast yard, nor yet for the mast itself, the only thing I couldn't replace. You remember the partners, for example?" Stephen had a vague recollection of Jack striking a marlin spike into wood and soft splinters flying. He, too, shook his head, looking grave. And in decency he paused a moment before asking when he might reasonably hope to see an albatross. "Poor dear," said Jack, his mind still with his ship. "I'm afraid she's growing old. All the spirit in the world but Anno Domini can't be beat. Albatross. Why, I dare say we may sight one before we reach the height of the Cape. I'll put it in orders that you're to be told the moment an albatross is seen." Day after day, the figure of the noon altitude rose. 26 degrees 16 minutes. 29 degrees 47 minutes. 30 degrees 58 minutes. Every day the air grew colder. Guernsey frocks and fur hats were seen, pitiably reduced by their passage through the tropics, and the officers' uniforms were no longer a torment to them. And every day, several times every day, Stephen was called on deck to see mollyhawks, Cape pigeons, petrels, for now they were in the rich waters of the South Atlantic, waters that could and did support Leviathan, who might often be seen sporting in the distance. Once, indeed, a bump in the night, a momentary check in the frigate's way, showed that they had come into immediate contact with him. South and south forever. Beyond the zone where the trades were born, boring steadily through uncertain, variable airs, cold, cold airs, towards the Roaring Forties, where the west wind, sweeping without a pause round the whole watery globe, would carry them eastwards beyond the tip of Africa. Week after week of determined sailing, with the sun lower at every noon, lower and, as it were, smaller.
brilliant, but with no warmth in it, while at the same time the moon seemed to grow. It was strange to see how quickly this progress took on the nature of ordinary existence. The surprise hadn't run off 1,000 miles before the unvarying routine of the ship's day, from the piping up of the hammocks to the drumbeat of heart of oak for the gunroom dinner, thence to quarters, and the incessantly repeated exercising of the guns, and so to the setting of the watch, obliterated both the beginning of the voyage and its end. It obliterated even time, so that it seemed normal to all hands that they should travel endlessly over this infinite and wholly empty sea, watching the sun diminish and the moon increase. Both were in the pale sky on a memorable Thursday, when Stephen and Bondon resumed their customary places in the mizzen-top, dismissing its ordinary inhabitants and settling down upon the folded stunsels. Bondon had graduated from pothooks and hangers far north of the line. He'd skimmed his ignoble slate overboard in 3 degrees south. Now he was yardarm to yardarm with pen and ink. And as the southern latitude mounted, so his neat hand grew smaller and smaller and smaller. "Verse," said Stephen. It was an inexpressible satisfaction to Bondon to write in metre. With a huge, childish grin, he opened his inkhorn and poised his attentive pen, a booby's quill. "Verse," said Stephen again, gazing at the illimitable blue-grey sea and the lopsided moon above it. "Verse. Then we upon our globe's last verge shall go, and view the ocean leaning on the sky. From thence our rolling neighbours we shall know, and on the lunar world securely ply—"
"By God, I believe I see the albatross!"
"Believe I see the albatross," said Bondon's lips silently. "It don't rhyme. Another line, sir, maybe?" But receiving no answer from his rigid teacher, he looked up, followed his gaze, and said, "Why, so you do, sir. I dare say he'll fetch our wake directly and overhaul us. Wonderful great birds they are, though something fishy without you skin 'em. There are some old-fashioned coves that has a spite against them, which they say bring ill winds." The albatross came nearer and nearer, following the ship's wake in a sinuous path, never moving its wings, but coming up at such a pace that what was a remote fleck when Stephen first saw it was an enormous presence by the time Bondon had finished his receipt for albatross pie. An enormous white presence with black wingtips 13 feet across, poised just astern. Then it banked, shot along the side, vanished behind the cloud of sails, and reappeared 50 yards behind the ship. Messenger after messenger ran into the mizzen-top. "Sir, there's your albatross, 2 points on the larboard quarter," Ahmet reported in Urdu. And immediately afterwards his dull blue face was thrust aside by a ship's boy from the quarter-deck with, "Captain's compliments, sir, and he believes he's seen the bird you were asking after."
"Maturin! I say, Maturin, here's your albatross!"
This was Bose, the purser, clambering up by the power of his hands, trailing his game leg. At last Bondon said, "My watch is called, sir. I must be going asking your pardon, or Mr. Rattray will give me the rub. May I send up a pea-jacket, sir? It is mortal cold."
"Aye, do,"
murmured Stephen, unhearing, rapt in admiration. The bell struck. The watch changed. One bell. 2 bells, 3, the drum for quarters, the beating of retreat,
No guns, for once, thank God. And still he gazed. And still, in the fading light, the albatross wheeled, dropped astern, occasionally alighting for some object thrown overboard, ran up in a long series of curves, the perfection of smooth, gliding ease. The days that followed were among the most trying that Stephen had spent at sea. Some of the forecastlemen, old South Sea whalers, were passionate albatross fishers. After his first vehement outburst, they wouldn't offer to do it when he was on deck. But as soon as he went below, a line would be privily veered out, and the great bird would come flapping in to be converted into tobacco pouches, pipe stems, hot dinners, down comforters to be worn next to the skin, and charms against drowning. No albatross ever drowned. As many as half a dozen were following the ship now, and not one of them was ever seen to drown, blow rough, blow smooth. He knew that morally his case was weak, for he had bought and skinned the first specimens. He was most unwilling to invoke authority, but he was much occupied in the sick bay, the opening of case 113, 3-year-old pork that had seen its time in the West Indies station, had produced something surprising in the dysentery way. 2 pneumonias as well. And in the end, worn out by darting up and down, he appealed to Jack. "Well, old Stephen," said he, "I'll give the order if you wish, but they won't like it, you know. It's against custom. People have fished for albatrosses and mutton birds ever since ships came into these seas. They won't like it. You'll get wry looks and short answers, and half the older hands will start prophesying woe. We shall run into a widow-maker or hit a mountain of ice." "From all I read, and from all Pullings tells me, it would be safe enough to foretell a gale of wind in 40 degrees south." "Come," said Jack, reaching for his fiddle. "Let's play the Boccherini through before we turn in. We may not have another chance this side of the Cape with your upsetting the natural order of things." The wry looks, the reproachful tones, began the next morning. So did the prophecies. Many a grizzled head was shaken on the forecastle, with the ominous words, profoundly true, and not altogether outside Stephen's hearing, "We shall see what we shall see." South and south she ran, flanking across the west wind, utterly alone under the grey sky, heading into the immensity of ocean. From one day to the next, the sea grew icy cold, and the cold seeped into the holds, the berth deck and the cabins, a humid, penetrating cold. Stephen came on deck, reflecting with satisfaction upon his sloth, now a parlour boarder with the Irish Franciscans at Rio, and a secret drinker of the altar wine. He found the frigate was racing along under a press of canvas, lying over so that her deck sloped like a roof and her lee chains were buried in the foam. 12.5 knots were the wind on her quarter. Royals, upper and lower stunsails, almost everything she had. Her starboard tacks aboard, for Jack still wanted a little more southing. He was there, right aft by the taffrail, looking now at the western sky, now up at the rigging. "What do you think of this for a swell?" he cried. Blinking in the strong, cold wind, Stephen considered it. Vast, smooth waves, dark, mottled with white, running from the west diagonally across the frigate's course, 200 yards from crest to crest. They came with perfect regularity, running under her quarter, lifting her high, high, so that the horizon spread out another 20 miles, then passing ahead so that she sank into the trough, and her courses, her lower sails,
sagged in the calm down there. In one of these valleys that he saw was an albatross, flying without effort or concern. A huge bird, but now so diminished by the vast scale of the sea that it might have been one of the smaller gulls. "It is grandiose," he said.
"Ain't it?" said Jack. "I do love a blow."
There was keen pleasure in his eye, but a watchful pleasure, too. And as the ship rose slowly up, he glanced again at the topsail stunsail. As she rose, the full force of the wind laid her over, and the stunsail boom strained forward, bending far out of the true, all the masts and yards showing this curving strain. They all groaned and spoke, but none like the twisting stunsail booms. A sheet of spray flew over the waist, passing through the rigging and vanishing over the larboard bow, soaking Mr. Hales, the gunner, as it passed. He was going from gun to gun with his mates, putting preventer breechings to the guns to hold them tighter against the side. Rattray was among the booms, making all fast and securing the boats. All the responsible men were moving about with no orders given. And as they worked, they glanced at the captain, while he, just as often, put out his hand to test the strain on the rigging, and turned his head to look at the sky, the sea, the upper sails.
"This is cracking on," said Jolliffe.
"It'll be cracking off presently," said Church, "if we don't take in."
For a glass and more, the watch on deck had been waiting for the order to lay aloft and reduce sail before the Lord reduced it himself. Yet still the order didn't come. Jack wanted every last mile out of this splendid day's run. And in any case, the frigate's tearing pace, the shrill song of her rigging, her noble running lift and plunge filled him with delight. A vivid ecstasy that he imagined to be private, but that shone upon his face, although his behaviour was composed, reserved, and indeed somewhat severe. His orders cracked out sharp and quick, as he sailed her hard, completely identified with the ship. He was on the quarterdeck, yet at the same time he was in the straining stunsail boom, gauging the breaking point exactly.
"Yes," he said,
as though a long period of time hadn't passed. "And it'll be more grandiose by half before the end of the watch. The glass is dropping fast, and it'll start to blow presently. Just you wait until this sea gets up and starts to tumble about. Mr. Harrowby? Mr. Harrowby, another man to the wheel, if you please. And we'll get the flying jib and stunsails off her." The bosun's pipe, the rush of feet, and her tearing speed sensibly diminished. Mr. Stanhope, clinging to the companion ladder, cruelly in the way, said, "It's a wonder they don't fall off, poor fellows. This is exhilarating, is it not, like champagne?" So it was, with the whole ship vibrating, and a deep bass hum coming from the hold, and the clean, keen air searching deep into their lungs. But well before nightfall, the clean, keen air blew so strong as to whip the breath away as they tried to draw it in, and the surprise was under close-reefed topsails and courses, t'gallant masts struck down on deck, running faster still, and still holding her course southeast. During the night, Stephen heard a number of bumps and cries through his sleep, and he was aware of a change of course, for his cot no longer swung in the same direction. But he was not prepared for what he saw when he came on deck. Under the low, grey, tearing sky, half-driving rain, half-driving spray, the whole sea was white. A vast, creaming spread as far as eye could see. He had seen the Bay of Biscay at its worst,
and the great southwest gales on the Irish coast, they were nothing to this. For a moment, the whole might have been a wild landscape, mountainous yet strangely regular. But then he saw that the whole was in motion.